Hi, everybody. This is Steve Savitsky, and today we have Shraga Simmons, who is a journalist, a writer, and has written a very interesting book called David and Goliath. I had the great pleasure of meeting Shraga when I was in Israel just recently. We met on Har HaZeitim, gave me a copy of his book, which is really fascinating, all about the explosive inside story of media bias in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Shraga, how are you today?
Doing great. A little under the gun here in Israel with the whole Iran issue heating up, but we have a lot of emuna and kind of anxious to see how it'll all play out.
Okay. Well, listen, hopefully it'll play out very well, God willing. So you wrote this book called David and Goliath, and I guess who's the David, who's the Goliath?
That's a great question. Obviously, Israel is the David. That's King David who slung his slingshot and defeated the Goliath, but Israel, even during its formative years, from saying starting in 1948, was really viewed by the world that way. This upstart underdog nation who had a bunch of ragtag Holocaust survivors who were able to defeat five or seven Arab armies, and that was the narrative that held in the media for about 20 years. And then following 67, something really flipped. And what flipped was that Israel, which was the tiny speck of land in this vast Middle East with 640 times the size Arab landmass. So in 1967, there became an entity, at least in the world's eyes, which was smaller than Israel, and that was the Palestinians. And the media just flipped the whole narrative, and the Palestinians became the David, and that's the way things have been going. And
so now, since that time, basically Israel has become the Goliath, the Palestinians are the David, and when you look at world and you look at the news, what's going on, somehow Israel is being portrayed as this monster organization, state, that has kept these poor people under wraps and does not give them any freedom, correct?
Yeah, that's the narrative. And part of the reason the media does this is because, they need to keep things interesting. So I call it kind of a reality TV scenario where, if you know how that works, you have real people and real individuals, and they have, you can't totally script the way reality TV goes, but with a lot of careful editing and selective omission on certain things over another, you can pretty much kind of stick to a storyline that the producers of the show have determined. And that's similar to the way the media works. They obviously have to work within the confines of the characters in the Middle East drama, but they have selected a certain narrative, which is Israel the Goliath and against the slingshot Palestinians the David, and that's the ongoing narrative, and that's how it keeps interesting. And the Palestinians are the underdog, and America has always been infatuated with the underdogs, whether it's Rocky Balboa or the U.S. Olympic hockey team. And I mean, America itself was founded as an underdog, so that's the way things are going. In fact, interestingly, in a recent interview, Barack Obama proudly declared that even as the incumbent, he is the underdog in the 2012 presidential race. So it's a good position to be in, and that's the position the Palestinians are in.
So they're in this position, and it seems to be perpetuating itself. So what can be done about it?
I mean, the first thing is to be aware that it's happening, that the media is not... It used to be, Steve, that, back in the days, maybe when we were growing up, and Walter Cronkite and these, that the media was... just giving us the news. Media was giving us the news straight, and that's how we accepted it. I'm sure there was a little slant, but pretty much it was you were getting what the truth was, and that really all changed when the networks realized that money can be made on news, and it became a little bit more. It kind of moved more toward the entertainment division, and so the awareness that we're not necessarily getting the news straight—that's the—that's the first thing. And then the second step is to call the media on it, and to say we're not willing to accept this. And if you want to continue to do this, that's okay, but don't present yourselves as objective source of news.
Okay, so you talk about in your book, you talk about the techniques that they use to create this negative perception. So let's talk about two or three. What are they?
Well, one technique would be, I would say, is what I call selective omission. So just for example, we'll take the Iran example because it's pretty much on everybody's mind.
Good.
Is
great. Okay.
Yeah. So let's just say like this. So 3 weeks ago, the Ayatollah made a major address to the Iranian nation, where he said that Israel is a cancerous tumor that must be removed. So the New York Times reported on this speech, as they necessarily had to do. It was a major address, major international story, but they left out that quote, which was the most salient point of the whole address, the very direct existential threat to Israel. They left that quote out, and they said instead that Israel has some concern about a nuclear Iran. That was the extent of the portrayal of that. And also, for example, when Ahmadinejad made his proclamation that Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth, the New York Times translated the original Farsi into Israel should be erased from the pages of time. Far more mild, poetic in a way. And this is just one example of how the media would downplay that threat by just subtly redirecting the focus of things, let's say.
Okay, so it's selective quotes and omission of things that they feel may prejudice people one way or the other, and they want to prejudice them one way, so they keep in the quotes they want and take out the quotes they don't want.
That's it. That's the whole story.
Okay, so they do that. Okay, so, but isn't one of the real issues, I always think, it's that this conflict has gone on for a long, long time. People don't have much of an attention span. And they're tired. They're tired of this conflict. Now, it seems that Israel is the one that can solve the conflict because they have the land and they control everything. And if they wanted to, all they have to do is just want to end it and it could be over. I mean, but yet we know the real reason it's not over is because the other side. How do you get that message out? Or, I mean, am I being wrong about what I'm saying now?
So part of the problem of Israeli Hasbara is that we're always on the defensive. So, for example, whether it's whatever the case happens to be, whether it's trying to stop a Gaza flotilla or whether it's going into Jenin to root out terrorists or even going all the way back to taking out the Iraqi nuclear reactor 30 years ago. Israel is not, we're not prepared, I don't believe we're laying the foundation, the groundwork ahead of time, what I like to call a preemptive strike against the media, which is basically anticipating that anything that Israel is going to do is going to be met with this kind of widespread condemnation, whether it's at the United Nations, where there's a majority block of third world Muslim countries, or just the media itself, which is for their own purposes, presenting Israel as the aggressor. So if we are preemptive about it, kind of prepare, get the message out there that this is a problem, the media bias is an issue, and that it's going on, and that here's Israel's position before the event happens, then I think we can certainly mitigate the negative response.
But Shraga, didn't they actually do that in Gaza? I mean, when they knew they were going into Gaza, they prepared the world for it. They set the stage for it. And then the Goldstone Report comes out and basically says Israel was completely wrong.
Right. Well, that was, unfortunately, you had a few number of individuals who were, I guess you could say, intentionally preparing a negative report against Israel. I don't think you can ever, I mean, outright lying, I don't think you're ever going to be able to deal with that. I mean, that also is what happened in Jenin. And
okay, let's talk about that, because you have a whole chapter in the book about Jenin and what happened. So let's talk about reality, what really happened. Then let's talk about what was reported, and then let's talk about what happened when the truth came out. Let's take that situation.
Well, reality is we were trying to root out terrorists. The fighting in Jenin was limited to about 0.1% of the city, one small neighborhood, a few number of houses. I believe the number of Palestinians killed was 52, the majority of whom were armed combatants. The problem was, it's not so simple to embed journalists in a military battle. In fact, the U.S. government, even though they did that during the Iraqi invasion, later came to regret it because it's complicated. You actually become responsible for the safety of the journalists. There's certain things that the soldiers themselves can't really do freely because they have to be concerned that their cover will be blown, so to speak, by someone listening in. So it is complicated, and it's not a simple thing. So that's basically the position that Israel took then, and you do create an information vacuum. And the mistake that was made is that the vacuum was not filled by the Israelis. It was left open to be filled by the Palestinians, and now we all know what happened.
So what should they have, in retrospect, so what should Israel have done?
I think what Israel should have done is before letting the journalists into Jenin to snoop around and after the battle was over, that's when the journalists went in and they were snooping around and found some Palestinians willing to lie. In the meantime, of course, the Palestinian spokesmen were on CNN lying as well. So the solution would have been to have major briefings with videos, with whatever evidence could have been provided before the journalists went in, so that they're prepped. Again, you're preempting the negative strike.
But you know that, in other words, like we all know what the tactics are of Hamas and so on, putting launch pads in schools and hospitals and so on. So if there's another war, okay, Israel knows what they have to do. The minute they strike a hospital or a school, they're condemned day one. There's nothing they can do to change world opinion about that. No matter how ferocious this attack could be, no matter how bad it is, one Israeli bomb on a school or a hospital, negative PR all over the place.
Well, unfortunately, there's a double standard which has been operating against Israel because during the same time that Israel was in Jenin, there were NATO troops were bombing in Afghanistan, killing dozens of civilians, and the United States was performing operations trying to find Saddam Hussein and his family and top henchmen, killing dozens of civilians. And I'm not saying it's not for me to judge what is right or wrong. There's international standards about this, but there is a double standard that operates against Israel, and I think it's partly because we're the Jewish state. And let me say like this: there's one position you can take is we should fight against a double standard being perpetuated against us. And it is objectively there is that double standard. But on the other hand, maybe we should just stand up and say, and I would, really like to see an Israeli government official stand up and say, we welcome the double standard because we do hold ourselves to a higher standard, and we're the people that brought these standards of morality to the world. So we're happy to have a double standard, and we're happy to try to uphold that, but it needs to be stated if the world decides to condemn us for accidentally hitting a school in Gaza. So it needs to be stated that Israel, that even though this would be a non-condemnable action if it were done by another country, but because Israel is the, whatever you want to call it, light unto the nations, then
right.
Then Israel will be held to that standard. And that's fair, because at least it's being forthright about the fact that this double standard exists.
Why should Israel want to be on a higher standard than the United States? I mean, if you look at what happened in Afghanistan, you can get the papers every day and see about quote-unquote collateral damage that happened when they were bombing or they had a drone and they unfortunately killed X amount of people. So why does Israel have to be on a higher standard than the United States? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I'm not saying that we should voluntarily, in international forums, put ourselves on that pedestal. But if the world has some, let's call it an intuitive, historical sense that the Jewish people should be held to a higher standard, then then if that's the decision that the world or the media wants to make, so you can't really argue with that, even though it might make things more difficult for us, and maybe just from a military diplomatic standpoint, we wouldn't necessarily invite that on ourselves.
Right.
Necessarily, but if it's going to be done, so at least it should be stated that way. If it's not stated that way, so the average consumer is not able to pick up the subtlety where Israel is condemned for hitting a school, X number of people are killed, and which always, by the way, the number, the actual casualty count goes way down once the investigation is done. But people aren't able to pick up the subtlety of hey, isn't that the same thing that happened in Afghanistan? So it just sounds bad, and that's where it's left.
And what happened with CNN? I mean, they've become the villain. Why? What happened to them?
Well, when I first got involved in fighting media bias, it became clear to me that I wasn't going to be able to take on every media outlet. So I figured if I could pick one who was kind of at the top of the pyramid, and get them to change their approach, then that would trickle down and influence all the other media. So CNN, if you're a Western journalist living in Jerusalem, reporting on the conflict, so the first thing you do, you wake up in the morning, make yourself a cup of coffee, and flick on CNN to see what's happening, what's the news, and what story you're going to cover that day. So CNN was really setting the tone for the rest of the Western media. And I figured if I could kind of hammer away at them and get them to change their approach, then we could really do something.
So have you been successful?
Well, it was very difficult because at first, what would happen was I would bring CNN, I would show them a particular news item which was clearly biased against Israel, and they would agree, they would admit that that's correct, but they would say, we also sometimes, okay, these things creep in, but we also sometimes will do things that are biased against the Palestinians, and therefore everything balances out. And as proof of that, they said that we get complaints both from pro-Israeli people and from pro-Palestinian people. So that proves that everything is balanced out. And I didn't buy that because, intuitively I didn't think it was correct, but then I actually asked myself, that perhaps I'm the one who's biased because I do have a particular perspective, being Jewish, living in Israel. So there is that inclination to see things right. from pro-Israel eyes. So I basically decided the only way to prove this once and for all is to do an objective statistical study, and I printed out the 133 articles from CNN.com that appeared in the first month of the Intifada, this is going back 11 years, and analyzed them by asking questions, what's the preponderance of photographs, both of Israelis, of Palestinians, who's getting quoted more often, Israelis, Palestinians, a number of questions, and across the board, I found that CNN was biased in favor of the Palestinians by a factor of 2-1. Basically,
really?
Wow. Across the board, and that really was a epiphany, a turning point for myself, just in terms of having the confidence to go forward, believing in the justness of my cause, and that there really was a problem here, and that we could fix it. And eventually, we got actually CNN to make some real changes.
And today, they've made those changes.
Well, I mean, when the whole thing hit. Interest. I mean, part of my strategy was I figured that CNN, being like any other company, has a product. Their product is objective news. The most trusted name in news is what they call themselves. So I figured if I could create some public perception that their product was faulty, just like I just saw that the McLaren stroller company went out of business because there was this perception that their strollers were faulty,
right.
and that's it. That's all it takes. So we basically waged a massive public campaign to show that CNN was biased, and with the hope that it would eventually affect their bottom line. And the same week that Fox News overtook CNN in the ratings, and this was the first time since Ted Turner had founded CNN years earlier that CNN slipped from the top spot. That same week is when I got a call from CNN executives saying, okay, let's talk about how we can make some changes and how we can cooperate a little more in terms of presenting the Israeli side more fairly. So that direct correlation.
Okay. So you talk about Israel's right to exist, which is always questioned. You talk about the fact that they get condemned more than anybody else. And when I go to Israel and I meet with people from the media, they say, listen, you have to understand, most of these people are based in Israel. They love life in Israel. And if they go to Lebanon or Syria, I'll tell you, who knows who can go to Syria, they go to Lebanon, they go down to Gaza. If they write an article, which is a negative article, they're not coming back there anymore. They're not invited back. Whereas here, they could do whatever they want, and they could walk down the streets of Tel Aviv and be happy. So isn't that really one of the reasons why we have such slanty reporting here?
You know, there's actually a built-in bias. I mean, I say that Israel is kind of conducting the PR battle with one hand tied behind its back, because it's a huge sense of intimidation in Arab areas. There's no freedom of the press, and there's many stories. Kind of the thing really got started back when the PLO had set up base in Lebanon in the early 1980s, and there were journalists, about a dozen journalists, Western journalists, who were killed during this time, threatened, disappeared, kidnapped. And what started happening was, just like you said, Steve, is that the journalists started to realize that if they want to continue to have access to the story, they basically can't be going public with this intimidation. So you had, for example, one incident where a group of journalists from the top media outlets, Associated Press, New York Times, Washington Post, and Newsweek, were all kidnapped. They were kidnapped by a pro-Palestinian faction in Lebanon. And when they were released, there was nothing in the media. It wasn't reported. None of the media outlets themselves and the individual journalists, there was not a word that appeared about it anywhere. It later came out that the journalists themselves had made a pact between themselves that they weren't going to report it because they knew it would be dangerous and they would just have to leave. That's it.
Really?
They would have to, yeah.
So, I mean, it sounds like, you know, the deck is stacked against us. So, I mean, there's really not much we can do. I mean, do we just have to accept it and say, look, we know this is how they're going to report the news no matter what we do. Try to do the best we can, better Hasbara, better people who on, be a bit more proactive. But in the final analysis, it's going to happen because just the nature of the game.
Well, it's going to happen. Look, it's like saying, you're in any conflict, even let's say you're in a sports team, you got four guys in your team, the other team has six. So you could say, okay, we're doomed from the start, but if you redouble your efforts, so you can really do something. I mean, I think one approach that I'm trying to that I'm working on right now is a little bit more indirect, not dealing with the media directly, but just bolstering people's identification as being pro-Israel. You see these polls. I saw a recent CNN poll. The numbers are anywhere from 70% to 80% of Americans who are pro-Israel. The question is, how is that concretized? So my idea, for example, is to, and with the whole Iran thing coming up, and there's this whole idea that two generations ago, you know, the world stood by, allowed the Holocaust to happen. There were no mass rallies in Washington calling on the president to bomb the railroad tracks to Auschwitz, and there was no coordinated campaign demanding that the media fairly report on what was happening. And we know now that the New York Times had a specific policy to downplay what was happening during the Holocaust. It's well documented, but today with Iran pursuing nuclear capability, the question is, I believe that for each individual to kind of look back and say, hey, during the Holocaust, they didn't take a stand, they didn't take a position, they didn't demand justice for the Jews in Europe. And what I'd like to see is some type of public campaign which puts it into that perspective, where people would commit, even not commit to necessarily doing anything, but as a first step, to commit that I will not allow a second Holocaust to happen. Mm-hmm. And for people to put their names down, go on record, that I'm willing to take a stand. Once that's done, then I think we can utilize that base and then get people to do activist things, whether it's a rally, whether it's writing letters, whether it's protesting media treatment or whatever it is, sanctions, the whole thing. But just getting people on the most basic fundamental level, the people who are already identifying with Israel, to take a pledge and to concretize it for themselves, so that each individual goes on record. It's like we have this concept in Judaism, where when we say the Al Chait on the Yom Nirayim, we say it out loud. Why do we have to articulate it? Vidui. Why does it have to be articulated? When it's put into words, it becomes concretized, and that's I think right. One very lamaisa thing that we can do for people with people today.
Okay, listen, I think that's a very practical suggestion, and I think you're right. So what I'm going to do to the people who are listening in the listening audience is, the name of the book is called David and Goliath, written by Shraga Simmons, S-I-M-N-O-N-S. I'm sure you could probably get it on Amazon or someplace if you want, right?
Right.
Is that true?
That's
and,
the easiest point.
It's really, really fascinating book. I read it, and in the back of the book they have some quotes of different people. One of them is our famous mayor of New York, famous mayor, Ed Koch. David and Goliath is an invaluable for anyone wanting the inside story. So listen, I commend you for writing the book. Thank you so much, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future. Okay, be well. Take care. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for all you do.
Bye-bye.